grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 319 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. Now, well over, I want to say, like, 3 days of material out there. Feel free to stop on by dudesandbeer.com anytime to find any of that. Every episode is there. We may be going through a few changes in the Dudes and Beer world, folks, so keep your ears perked up for that. Some new logo changes, maybe. Some new name changes, maybe. We'll see. We're in the midst of it, so stay tuned for that information. While you are online checking everything out at the Dudes and Beer podcast, dudesandbeer.com, make sure to stop on by in the right-hand widget area. You can see the Dudes and Beer podcast app there. There's also a Dudes and Beer app page, dudesandbeer.com/app. Stop on by. Click the big Android picture. Sorry, Orchard Dwellers. We will be getting to you as soon as we can. But it's available for Android, not up on any platforms except for Dudes and Beer. Click that Android picture. You'll see a download the APK. This way you don't have to give your privacy to anybody. How about that? Save the file. Click the file once it's on your mobile device and it will automatically install. Absolutely great. Super fun. You can tune into all the episodes live while we are on the air. You can also check out past episodes. There's a chat feature there. There's a question feature where you can send in questions to guests. All kinds of stuff. Dudesandbeer.com/app is the website. While you're online checking that out, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer Facebook group. That is where you can find all the stuff that we post, all of the great articles, everything else, and everything that we pull for the news of the week here at Dudes and Beer. Let's check out some of the headlines that we have posted over the last week. This actually was breaking 2 hours ago. I posted about 10 minutes into the breaking titles and have been looking for updates. But out of NBC News, U.S. Navy ship fires warning shots after Iranian boats come close. That's what we want to hear. It is official, folks. If you have a vaccine, the CDC has said that you may gather in small groups unmasked. Right here is a great chart from the CDC itself, from MSNBC or NBC News. Once again, go by, check that out. All kinds of fun stuff there. We've also got Skullduggery, what the CIA's notorious mind control program did, and did they create an infamous killer? That's out of Yahoo News. Another NBC article. Here's what outdoor activities are safe to do without a mask. We've also seen in the last week, a little girl in Belvidere County is in trouble for selling her chickens' eggs. That's right down the road in San Antonio. In addition, a GOP congressman's bill would protect marijuana consumers' Second Amendment rights. Not many people realize, there are so many people out there, myself one of them included, the advocacy that goes on behind legalizing marijuana, behind and just the all-out campaign, the BS campaign that has gone on for longer than my parents' life against it, and the medical benefits that are there, CBD, all kinds of stuff. CBD is so commonplace now, it's on my recommend list from my doctor here in Texas. So not many people realize, though, that when you get that medical marijuana card, that that might, in some states, preclude you from being able to purchase a firearm and exercise your Second Amendment right. Not a lot of people are aware of that, sadly. I know a couple people who have found out the hard way, and it's kind of sad. It's kind of horrible to see. So good to see that there are people out there checking that out, doing things about that. For more news, everything else, stop on by Facebook. Check out Dudes and Beer. Follow the page. Follow the group. Great conversations there without things getting nasty about all kinds of stuff. Of course, make sure to stop on by True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is based right here in Austin, Texas. They are the makers of some of the best darn CBD around. I love them. I travel the country for a living, and every city I go to, whenever I hit a dispensary, I always buy CBD. These guys, hands down, have gotten more money from me that I don't care who it is. Like, I had a discount code for Tommy Chong stuff, and it's nowhere near as good as this. I haven't tried Joe Rogan's yet, but I'd definitely give it the Pepsi try up against True Hemp Science. I'll tell you that. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Use the code DUDE7. To save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get two entire edibles, cookie or brownie up to 50 milligrams. So you get two 25 milligram edibles for free on your order of $50 or more, as well as 7% off your total purchase with code DUDE7 when you visit TrueHempScience.com. One of my favorites is their CBD toothpicks, cinnamon flavored. If you're an old school cinnamon toothpick fan like me, really is kind of like a deep hug while you go through your day. I typically start off the day with one of their gummies, and each one of these is 25 milligrams themselves. So everything there is made from whole plant, not just part of the plant, not just an extract of part of the plant, but the whole plant. Everything uses an emulsification process. They have H2O made stuff. Fantastic. True Hemp Science is the website. DUDE7 is the code to save 7% and get two 25-gram edible cookies or brownies. While you are online checking that out, make sure to check out everything from our next sponsor, Podcast Cadet. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. Right, folks, stop on by. PodcastCadet.com is the website. Little disclaimer, I am actually one of the founders there, and we love helping people out. We love the world of podcasting. We love nothing more than helping people achieve their dream of doing so, whether it's for business, church, school, fun, whatever. Stop on by, check it out. DUDES20 is the code that you want to use to save 20% off your entire cart. Our guest tonight. Oh, wait, before our guest tonight, I got a special thanks to say to our good friend Joshua Shapiro of Crystal Skull Explorers. I want to thank you for the amazing skull. I love my Crystal Skull. Stop on by and check them out. They are not sponsors whatsoever. I got a Crystal Skull, and as you all know, I love my crystals. They change the atmosphere around me, and this thing has utterly changed the focus in this space. over the last week since it has been here. In addition to that, guest announcement for next week, my man, Graham Phillips. I cannot wait to have Graham Phillips back on. We have had him on to discuss his book, Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge. We have had him on to discuss his work with The Haunted Mirror and Alice in Wonderland. He's also the author of Merlin and Avalon of the New World. And we will be talking with him about his work to find the Staff of Moses, as well as Templars and the Ark of the Covenant. We just had a great episode about Templars in North America. We will be talking about the Ark of the Covenant, the search for the Ark of the Covenant. Is it still going on? Is it possibly on Oak Island? Is it possibly here in America, in the Southwest, as many believe? Was it taken to Africa, as posited numerous times? So we'll be getting into that next week with Graham Phillips. If you have any questions, make sure to stop on by, leave a message on the website, do it on Facebook, what have you. You can also, of course, always call the Dudes and Beer guest voicemail and leave your questions or comments. 512-677-4155. That number again is 512-677-4155. Our guest tonight, Dave Collis. David Collis is an artist. He is a researcher, and he is author of the book, Interviewing Jesus the Man. I, as usual, am about a third of the way through this book, about 5-6 chapters in, and I'm here to tell you the take on this is so utterly refreshing. As somebody who studied in the seminary for his first year in college, spent my life in service to my church before I just spiritually went down a different path. Still go to mass here and there, things like that, but that type of community is not necessary for me anymore spiritually. So I have moved forward, and some of what's in here, I think most churches are missing out on. When people, we have said it on this show so many times, when you go to read texts like the Bible, when you go to read these conglomerative works, you really do have to understand the people, the history, the area, the geography, there's so many different facets to understand the words and why they are arranged the way they are and what they might possibly actually mean. So our guest tonight, author of Interviewing Jesus the Man, David Collis, welcome to the show. How are you today, sir?
Christopher, I am doing really, really well.
Man, I mean, number one, my fingertips are numb already, which is not a bad thing, folks. That's not a circulatory issue. That's how I know that, like, my brain is going and that it's firing so fast that I am physically excited inside. And after our pre-show conversation, after reading your book, if you couldn't tell from our pre-show conversation, I am jazzed, man. You are such an entire breath of fresh air when it comes to the topic of Jesus the Nazarene. Before we really start getting into the topic and looking with lamplight through rabbit holes in the desert this evening, go ahead and tell our audience a little bit about yourself, about your journey, how you came to this topic to begin with, because I think everybody's journey, and not everybody's journey with this kind of stuff, comes through a lens of faith, necessarily. So familiarize our audience here in the next 5 minutes with just yourself, what you're about, and why you started into this field and realm of research, David.
Well, from a very, very early age, I have been interested in spirituality. I have had dreams, and I can recall my dreams. I've had mystical experiences. When I was a teenager, I was just completely interested in the concept of what our minds are capable of doing. I loved the Chariots of the God, and I loved the Bermuda Triangle and things like that. And then in my early 20s, I ended up having a mystical experience in which Jesus came to me. And so it wasn't just one or two mystical experiences. There were three of them. And then there were some others that were related to it. And that just kind of launched me on this pathway of really bearing down and digging deep into Christianity. And so my first take into Christianity was more of the traditional view of things. And then I found myself completely enamored by the Christian mystics and Thomas Merton and people like St. John of the Cross and Teresa Avila. And then from there, I got inspired by the Gnostics. And then it evolved a little bit further when Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code came out with Mary Magdalene at the center of the story. And I thought, well, what's the history of Christianity? And I really kind of from there, I just found myself just completely enamored with putting as much information together about this subject that I could. And so, again, I kind of had another very profound mystical experience in 2012 while I was reading the Gospel of Thomas, which is also attributed, you know, to the sayings of Jesus. There's 114 sayings of Jesus in this particular gospel. And in one instance, I was struggling to understand it. In the next instance, I completely understood these sayings. And then I realized right then and there that the person that we know as Jesus is very different than what the New Testament likes to describe him as.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And of all things in the universe to put in a box, why God? Why? And I fail to understand it. And so many intelligent people I know, David, are unable to cleave a wedge between spirituality and religion. It's like the world's strongest Velcro, you know? And it's hard for some people to dispassionately view one while participating in the other.
Yeah, it's the razor. You're walking the edge of a razor when you're talking about this stuff, because first of all, we're dealing with a material that when you talk about the divine or God is hard to describe. Mm-hmm. There's something completely innate about us that wants to understand that which is impossible to understand.
Yeah.
And we want to make sense of it.
Yep.
And I kind of refer to it, part of my research was also understanding the nature of civilization, and particularly agricultural civilization. And so what I kind of was thinking is that imagine agricultural society is a type of operating system. So you've got DOS. Remember when the personal computers came out, it was DOS, and then it was Windows 3.1. You know, I'm kind of dating myself here. So, and then, you know, eventually you get up into the more modern versions of these operating softwares. But, you know, in the beginning, an agricultural society, there were people were very keen and interested in trying to understand and know something and to participate with the unknown. And religion starts to make sense of the things that are uncertain. You know, there isn't a lot of certainty in the world. And when it came to this material, there was a way in which you can access it and a way in which you can describe it and the way in which you can participate it. And so that was kind of the way I look at it. It was like agricultural society 1.0. And then you had your own app and you had the app called religion. And then there was a lot of different types of religions. So people have been interested in this subject for a very, very long time. And it is when you come into religion, you are dealing with, at the very beginning, you're starting off with this premise that there is a divine being mm-hmm. that's out there and that there's yeah. some way that we can connect to it. And so we have been working through all these different methods on how to connect with that source.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And that's kind of whenever people ask me, that's how I set that hard definition is religion operates off the principle that there is a God or gods that you commune with other people of same belief and faith. It comes from a point of faith and belief in something unseen. You go to a building with other people of the same faith and you participate in things there. Spirituality is what you do with that on a day-to-day basis outside of that place and away from those people, be it that message or how you incorporate the world into your message or view. And once you have those, definitely defined, then it's, I think, a whole lot easier to start really poking and exploring. Aside from that, it can be really hard and rigid for some people to, let's just say, be willing to explore topics.
Yes.
Well, and just with an open mind, and even just being devil's advocate, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two subjects that you don't want to talk too much about, you know, at the dinner, you know, around the dinner table, and that's politics and religions, because things can flare up pretty quickly.
Well, and what's funny, though, David, is that the whole premise behind this show is you want to know how we got here? Because we don't talk about politics and religion anymore. Those those dudes at the Green Dragon Tavern who started this country, they talked about politics and religion openly,
yeah,
over a
yeah.
beer, and they were willing to yeah. disagree and come back the next Saturday and go, well, John, man, you believe what you believe. Go on, brother, you know,
yeah.
and just leave it at that. And when the winter came, you still gave them wood and they still gave you pork, you know, like. And somewhere along the line, we not only stopped talking, we stopped listening and just started waiting our turn to talk. And
well, I think you know, because I have a master's degree, so there was a lot of information that I found in the academic setting that was very refreshing, because you got to investigate in a manner that I felt comfortable investigating yeah. without any creed or dogma or anything that's kind of yeah. behind it, other than there's an openness and here's all this material, you know. So I found myself in libraries a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And then
I had to go out on my own. And, you know, once I had graduated both with a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, then I was on my own to really conduct another level of research. So.
And what was that?
Oh, well, again, it kind of goes back to the nature of Christianity and what are the characteristics of a birth of a religion? You know, we all think that you know, everything is already preset. It's already pre-known. It's all packaged. But, you know, there's a great deal of struggle and violence and uncertainty about creating, you know, new concepts of the divine yeah. and introduce those ideas into a society.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not an easy thing,
you know,
and it is a violent birth.
One of the things that we have talked about recently on this show, David, is the concept of the 100-year cycle. And the fact that there was a huge, 100 years ago, huge birthing of spiritualism, things like that. You see that a lot now, the birth of the paranormal movement. Every station has a paranormal show on it, you know, stuff like that. And even to go back further than that, and like you just said, birthing a religion takes time. If you look at the birthing of the first 200 years of the congealed Christian faith, when they really sat down and started like, okay, we have a church now. We are Christian. This is what we are. And you look at those first 200 years, you could almost parallel that exactly with where we are now in America from the birth of our country.
Where, yeah, there was a lot of difference, and there's a lot of turmoil, and there was yeah. a lot of strife.
Well, and there's a lot of, this is dogma. It cannot change. And it's like, well, yeah, but like, The understanding is different. Yep, but stays the same. Still doctrine. It's not going to change. Even though the reality is different, even though things are different. In the Catholic Church, I say it to people all the time. A, the world's oldest political organization. Hands down. Next to maybe the Sanhedrin. You know?
Not on the scale.
Not on that scale. Absolutely not.
Not on that scale. I mean, we're really talking about 2,000 years of perfecting an institution and
Absolutely.
The way you think and educate and you know, embrace culture and how you influence culture and how it's organized and how it fights its battles and things like that. Yeah. I mean, it's a quite an amazing institution.
It has been an amazing and an enormous undertaking and growth pattern, and even just to see the fact that, like, Vatican II did not happen until my mother was a child. You know?
Yeah. No, once these things are in place, they don't like to change too much. So what are we seeing right now? Change everywhere. Change, change, change. Everything is changing.
Well, and what I loved, like I said earlier, let's start cracking this nut real quick of interviewing the Jesus the man.
Yeah, let's get back to that, because there's all this other stuff that's really good stuff, too.
Well, to me, I think what we just talked about is a big preamble into what interviewing Jesus the man is about. Because most people, that to digest that information, to digest the socioeconomic situations going on between Jewish culture and the occupying Roman citizenry, to understand the world of Paul, to understand the world of Peter post-Jesus, politically, economically, religiously, is so important to understanding the words in the Bible. So important to understanding why the same situation in three different Gospels is described three different ways. You know? Like the call of the disciples, where it's like, bring just the shirt on your back. Then the next dude's like, bring your sandals and a walking stick. Well, one culture may have been like, what the heck's a walking stick?
Yeah.
You know? So, let's start getting into that real quick in the realm of research that you got into to start preparing what is literally fiction wrapped in conversation. It's amazing the way that you have taken, what I know to be a world of knowledge geographically, things like that, that took me years to accumulate are right here in the book. In a conversational form, and it puts it in such a comfortable way to read. Where did you start when it came to this?
Well, so as I mentioned, the kind of a mystical experience that I had when I was reading the Gospel of Thomas, that is when I went from trying to understand history to understanding that Jesus had a certain experience and that this experience was so profound that it really kind of changed him. And that you have to understand that Jesus was an enlightened being and that the people that he was speaking to were not. So from that point of view, when you read the Gospel of Thomas, you're looking at a person that had spent, you know, an enormous amount of time moving through all this territory of spirituality. Okay. So that was one thing. The other thing that was very important is that I ended up conducting a 4-part lecture series on the Gospel of Thomas. And one of the lectures that I gave was the relationship between the material and the community. So I was analyzing from, you know, it's almost as if I put on my FBI profiler's hat and I said, yeah, what kind of person would say this? How would they get this information? And then you also have the counterpart, and that's the audience. So who's the audience? The Gospel of Thomas, I like to use the metaphor, it's like calculus. Well, you can't just come walking into the calculus classroom without understanding algebra and geometry and trigonometry and all the, you know, basic mathematics. And then there's no way you're going to understand calculus. It's just not going to be possible unless you're a complete genius. But, you know, not a lot of people are. So that means you have to kind of start, you know, somewhat small. So who's the community that is behind the Gospel of Thomas when you're dealing with this level of calculus? It's too advanced for, you know, basic people. Sure. So that got me thinking about Jesus in a new way. And so from there, I then asked myself, I know that the New Testament, you know, and I got to just lay down this groundwork. We think the New Testament is history. It's not. It's not historical in the way that you and I would understand history. The Jews had a very different understanding of how truth is understood, and it doesn't necessarily have to fall within a historical context. What you can provide within a historical context is a setting to represent or to tell about certain truisms. So I kind of like to think of it in, you're either making a documentary about something or you're going to make a movie based off of, you know, actual events, but you're going to fictionalize a lot of the events to dramatize the story. And what we're seeing in the Gospels is a type of dramatization. But even with this dramatization, you still have an enormous amount of deep metadata. And that metadata and all those little personal nuances is what I was looking at when I was trying to piece the personality and the person of Jesus back together. So the first thing I had to do was I said, I have to separate Jesus, the Son of God, the Son of Man, the second Adam, all of those deep symbolic archetypal ideas, strip that away and say, who are you?
Yeah.
Why did you do this? And what really is happening? And what path did you walk? How did you get from where you are hanging on a cross to getting started on a ministry and then everything that happened before you took that walk to John the Baptist?
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it was a series of decisions.
Exactly.
Like he doubted full on. Like, go read the accounts of the Garden of Gethsemane. Like, he was more than willing to just walk away. Right.
And then you ask yourself this question. Again, we go back to what you just mentioned, decisions. There are decisions that are being made, and once he makes a decision, that sets off a whole nother realm of possibilities.
Yes.
And that makes it all more interesting because I think Jesus was thinking, what is out there? And if you read, the Our Father prayer, you're going to see how Jesus walked and lived his life in service. So he starts off that there's a God and I give praise to them. And then he thanks him for, you know, not tempting it and for, you know, with his food and making sure that, I can't remember all the components of the Lord's Prayer. Oh, excuse me. It's God is in heaven. Give us your daily bread. Lead us not in temptation. Forgive those. And then more glory to God, right? So there's God's the bread. And then in between that is all the meat. And it is really, really basic stuff. Your daily bread. Don't lead us into temptation and forgiveness. And so when I was thinking about those three items, I had to ask myself, if I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here about, because this is not the That's lost okay. years, but the way he was looking at it is, if I'm going out into ministry, every day is going to bring something new, and I don't know what's going to happen. And I can tell you most of the things I'm going to say are most likely going to upset people. So the first thing I have to do is I'm going to have to just, you know, forgive them. And then I'm going to have to, I'm asking God not to lead me into a direction that is going to tempt me again. And I'm just very thankful for what I can eat each day. I mean, how simple can that get,
yeah,
right, when you're in service like that?
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is that when I analyzed even the Lord's Prayer, there was a lot of information just in that was telling me something about Jesus. And I took that same level of like FBI profiler and the glasses, and I'm seeing through now the veil with my X-ray glasses, and I'm looking into Jesus' life, and I'm starting to see something that was very different than what I was told and what I was taught and what I understood and what I had learned.
Yeah.
And then when I finally got, and this is what happened to me, is when I finally got a picture of him, I had an oh my God moment. This is unbelievable. And I said to myself, I think I'm seeing Jesus for the first time in 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So here's the other kind of thing that we have to kind of grapple with. It's the elephant in the room. Not only is the Gospels, they're not like hardcore history, like again that I said that we would understand.
Yeah.
But there's information in there that is, you know, more likely true than not. So I had to kind of go through and ask myself, is this true? Is this not? This would seem likely to be true. This isn't. And then I had studied these scholars for the Jesus Seminar. And of course, they put together an entire list of all the sayings of Jesus, and they color coded which ones they felt were most likely Jesus and which were not. And so I took the ones that were the most likely of his and I put them together and I said, okay, what's the psychological and personality profile of this person? And
interesting.
So, and again, as I go back, there's metadata in all of his sayings. There's another thing that started to happen to me, and that is when I did all of this and I compiled all of his sayings, I put them in, it turned out that all of his sayings added up to 25 pages of single-spaced lines. 25 pages. That, again, told me a lot. Like, if there's 25 pages of like 11-size font and I got and they're single-spaced, who is writing all of this down?
Yeah.
Who is, and these are all just Jesus' sayings. Who's writing this down? And how can you remember all of this? You can't just think, oh, you know, the first gospel, Mark, was written 40 years after Jesus. I can tell you this, Mark wasn't one of Jesus' disciples. So how did he know what to write down?
Yes, exactly.
So
precisely.
And if there's 25 pages, how can one person remember all of that unless you had a photographic memory? But all of his disciples were fishermen. So I doubt that they had, you know, the training to remember all of that. So two things are possible. Either somebody was writing it down. There's the Q document.
Yep.
Or Jesus kept repeating himself.
Yeah.
But there was so much information when it comes to his teachings that it made me believe that he wasn't repeating himself all the time, because then there was just so much of it that he couldn't talk about it all in like one sitting.
Yeah.
So, and he's not telling us, you know, when he goes from door to door, or not door to door, he went from village to village, town to town. You know, I would imagine that each time he went there, he probably had some set things that he wanted to say. But Jesus was trained as an orator.
Yeah.
So he knew how to speak to people at their level, at their time, and respond to them. So not only do we have the parables, which are types of teaching tools, but there are also his aphorisms, which are response to people's responses to him.
Yeah. Things like the Beatitudes, stuff like that, like, hey, teacher, what about this? And he's like, well, this, 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 and this. And if this, then that. We didn't really get into it at the beginning, but typically in episodes like this, we have a trigger warning, David. Because we have a lot of capital R religious listeners in this group. And a lot of capital S spiritual listeners. And that's why I was saying earlier, this can be hard to digest for some people. Now, it doesn't make it untrue. Nothing of what I have seen thus far in interviewing Jesus the man is not fact. I haven't seen anything thus far where it's like you get into your divine relation, divine revelation, or anything like that. Everything thus far is like you asking Jesus about why something happened, and he gives you an understanding of what was happening in the world and why he said what he said, why he did what he did. And
that's correct.
Once again, trigger warning, folks, because your host and former seminarian and 10-year teacher of religion and spirituality is about to come out and tell you, like, Jesus was straight up not who you think he was. Was he a rabble rouser? Sure. He was definitely overturning some apple carts, but in a way that you may not consider. And like I said before the show, David, I am a firm holder after having read the greater works of Solomon, stuff like that, and the greater keys of Solomon, after reading Kabbalah, stuff like that, that Jesus, especially at 12 years old, the only reason why the Sanhedrin and the high priest would be listening to him was he was an adept in studies like that, which were the order of the priests of Levi, that kind of stuff. The people who guarded the Holy of Holies. And you had to have a special realm of knowledge and spirituality and understanding of relationship with God and the world around you. Otherwise, like, you came near the ark, you were going to straight die, Jack. Unless you were somebody touched by God and fully understood God and the capital G creator expanse of the universe concept, you were probably going to fall ill in its presence. So when a 12-year-old has the captivated mind of those people, he's probably telling them a little bit of something.
Okay, and that was one of those bits of information that was very important to me when I was reconstructing Jesus's life.
Sure.
Because, you know, we're going from 12. So that episode and that story is when he is 12. So that's like his bar mitzvah.
Yep.
That moment on, until he conducts his ministry and he shows up at the Jordan River to get baptized by John the Baptist, there is nothing else.
Poof. Gone.
About his life.
Erased.
It is just
from
this one big black hole.
Yeah. Yeah. Straight up. Except for the Gospel of Thomas.
Well, there's a, okay. So that is, that's a different thing. So the question that I had was, if I read the New Testament, how can I get to the point of understanding what happened in his missing years? So is there anything that reflects that was going on in his ministry that would go look backwards to his life during those years? Those, what is that, 18 years? Those 18 years. What happened?
Yeah.
So I felt that the ministry was some reflected part of that period. So from there, I was able to determine, after collecting 25 pages of his sayings, I had an aha moment. And again, it was like one of those, I'm shaking now. Jesus is telling me his life story through his parables and some of his aphorisms. So Jesus is telling me his life. There's an autobiographical element to his stories. And that was a huge revelation. So I started to realize that if Jesus is saying certain things, there's elements of his life in those sayings. And that made it all the more interesting. So not only was I starting to see Jesus, you know, when it came back to piecing everything together, I had to, as you, we've talked a little bit about, I had to understand the historical context. And I had to understand, how did he come to know what he knows? And what does he know? And is this information consistent with the Hebrew knowledge? And I found that there was a rupture between what Jesus was saying and what Judaism at that time was saying.
Yes.
So then there's one other thing that I ask. And of course, you know, this is, you understand this. I ask a lot of questions. I'm a seeker like you. So you're always asking questions. And in that regard, I'm, you know, I was modeling myself after Plato and his dialogues. And that's kind of the way that I wrote my book was based off of Plato's dialogues.
Totally.
In which you're having this conversation with people to get deeper into these insights without having to be so academic that it became tedious and laborious and, well, you know, boring.
Well, and, you know, you say that. But one of the reasons why I love philosophy. And like, it is hard for me to read a novel. Very hard. Because there are no pictures. I'm not going to lie. However, you give me poetry. You give me philosophy. Philosophy to me reads like an instruction manual, which is what I live and breathe. So, like, to me, just reading the way that the philosophic mind works is painting a picture in my mind. It's like Thomas Aquinas was not rocket math for me. Like, once I learned that displaced way of reading it, you know, and like, you got to come here, then go here, then bounce back. And, oh, okay, cool. I love that stuff, and that's what I read 90% of the time, because that's just where my brain is and what I get. And like you said, there is in this book, there is a ton of heady information. Heady information. Things that, like, I read Josephus and stuff like that to get.
I had to, too.
And the way you break it down into a conversation, into, well, you know, let me explain to you why that happened. And within a paragraph or two, it's really fantastic. The facts that you weave into the literal story that help build the profile of Jesus, the man, and why he taught what he taught. And the way absolutely a rabbinic tradition, in the fact that it was storytelling. It was like, let me give you a parable example from my own tome of knowledge of life, you know, and yet still broken down to a way that every common person could understand it. And like a prime example of that kind of concept and understanding the world around it to understand the text would be the Ten Commandments. Seems like a lot of really in-depth stuff, but whenever you look at it, it's really simple. And it's fantastic rules for a bunch of people that actively know they're going to be wandering together in the desert for 40 years. Like, really common sense rules.
Well, those common sense rules were very necessary to have a tribal people move from being a tribe and working together as a tribe. And then, you know, obviously they transitioned into... And then they transition into a nation. So there are some things that are going to have – that are necessary.
Exactly.
That are going to be needed to create this promised land.
Yeah.
It's just that simple.
Well, and that's just it. And that it creates that very basic common understanding, you know, where it's like if you can get these – like you got 10 fingers – hopefully is what you came out with. And if you can understand one rule for each finger, you will as a society succeed. Period. Doesn't matter about God, like, you know, Christian God, whatever. If you just follow these precepts as people, don't steal each other's stuff. Don't think about your neighbor's goods as though you want them. You know, if you're picking up tent and moving and then staking up tent next to the same dude for 40 years, these are some really good rules to use.
It makes me believe that there weren't those rules, and those were the issues that were occurring.
Yeah.
So you have to say it. You have to go, hey, you don't need, we can't do this anymore, right?
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, even one step further to go into the Beatitudes of Christ and to discuss that topic and the teaching way that Christ kind of twisted that on itself when somebody came to him and was really trying to catch him up in the Jewish law. Because if you go back to like Leviticus, things like that, that is the book of Jewish law. And that's where you find out like how to wash your hands before you go into the temple, how to tell if a woman is ritualistically unclean, how to tell whether or not it's okay to sleep with animals as with men, things like that. And to know that one begat the other, and this new way of thinking was based on that and was really opening up a whole new world of understanding of our relationship with the divine, capital D, not even Christian God, Jewish God, the divine, the universe, our connection with every atom that surrounds us. It's pretty phenomenal. And you really do have to be willing to look at things dispassionately within the words of Christ and within the teachings and escape the quote, capital R, religious context of it.
Right. Well, so part of the research that I did was putting together a personality profile of Jesus. And one of the things you mentioned this, but if you think about, aside from the Gospel of Thomas, almost everything that Jesus spoke was very easy to hear. He wasn't heady. He doesn't form any arguments. He was just very simple, very basic. But there were things that he was asking you to do, so you had to put this in practice. So it was easy to hear, but it was really difficult to practice. Turn the other cheek. Walk an extra mile. And then there was also the things that he would say that were very easy to hear, but very difficult to understand. Like, the kingdom of heaven is inside of you. Or the sower, you know. His disciples were completely confused as to some of the things that he was saying all the time. And you see it in the New Testament Gospels, and you see it in the Why are they confused? That was the other question that I had asked. But anyway, let me just kind of mention, here are a couple of adjectives that describe Jesus that I was able to determine through my research. And that was, he was compassionate. As you kind of mentioned already before, he was a troublemaker. Here's a word that you probably don't use, and that is he was an entrepreneur.
Absolutely.
He was a provocateur. Yeah, so This was very, very important when I understood that concept that he was an entrepreneur. He was a provocateur. He was extremely determined. He was enigmatic. And that's also very important because people, again, were asking, well, what are you talking about? And he seems to constantly be throwing things out that were very strange and weird. And his brothers and sisters and his family at one point during a healing session grabbed him and pulled him out of the house saying that he was crazy.
Yep.
Jesus was very inclusive. He tried to be very inclusive, although he did have something to say against the priests and the kind of the teachers of his day. He seemed to not like what they had to say. He was a teacher, so there's a teaching mentality. He was a genius. Jesus was a mystic. He was very, very tough. And he has this other personality that was, when I realized this, it was just like, oh my God, there's just another thing to add to. He was a poet.
Yeah.
And so he was a wordsmith. And you know, as well as I know, when you're creating something, you just have to be completely immersed into your creation. And Jesus was creating through words. So in that regards, he was a bit of a magician because he understood how to cast spells through his words to get people to listen to him.
Oh, man. You just said it, and I'm not gonna let it pass by, because one of the day that I started studying Kabbalah, I had studied paganism, witchcraft, seals of Solomon, things like that, but until I started studying Kabbalah and really understood the concept of the numerology in it, the concept of every letter having a meaning and every letter having a number assigned to it. And specifically the idea, the big picture idea of the first letter stands for God. And the first letter's number is one. And without one, no other number exists. And it was like, whoa, you could not get a more basic proof than that right there. That exactly. Threw out all Euclidean concept of proof for me. Everything. It was like, wow, okay. So if we view this in the concept of the capital O, one, and we start going into creation, the way that Hebrew mystics would, and start looking at the fact that we uniquely amongst the animals of creation were the only one breathed into, which meant that mystically we had direct connection and that spirit of God and of creation inside of us uniquely, which meant anything that we spoke was.
That's a very profound concept. I love the idea that, you know, God breathed his image into us.
Yeah.
And I know that when, to me, that has taken on a much deeper reality.
Oh, than absolutely.
Just on the paper.
Absolutely. So, like at one point in my life when I was 20 and realized that, David, it was absolutely because, you know, Christ was in my heart at 45. That means the world and the universe is my oyster, and right. I am the pearl.
There you go.
I am
and
the
Jesus
pearl.
Talks about the kingdom of heaven is like the pearl, so.
I control my growth cycle and what happens in the tiny little envelope around me, you know, and the fact that I can take part in that creative aspect, in that part of manifestation. It's amazing and it's beautiful. And yes, these are the things that Christ was trying to teach. These are the reasons that the Sanhedrin and the high priests did not like. He wasn't intentionally, whenever we say rabble rouser, like that could give some people the wrong idea, David. Really, the fact is he was not afraid to lay it on the line and just say it how it was. And if that rocks your boat, I'm really, really sorry. On one occasion, he went out and started flipping over apple carts, literally. One. Aside from that, it was all with his words. And he was willing, even whenever, you know, the priest came up and tried to corner him, in that beautiful rabbi teaching style, was able to just flip it on its head.
And that kind of goes back to what he did at Passover, where he flipped the money merchants' tables. Mm-hmm. Jesus had a way about him. Now, so that was like kind of an act of violence and an aggressive act to get people's attention. But his whole ministry was technically flipping, metaphorically, the tables.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just like we said in the pre-conversation to this show, and what was happening with those money changers is Jews from all over were coming in, changing their local money to this money, and then buying sacrifice and place in line for the altar so that you could have a burnt sacrifice. And what Christ was trying to tell you the whole time was like, you don't need that dude between you and God. Like,
and when you you've start turned to, my temple, you've yeah. turned my temple
into a den of iniquity.
That's a den of iniquity. Thank you.
Den of iniquity. Like, you cannot get a more deriding statement than den of iniquity.
Yeah, because everything is, see, here's everything is based off of a contractual exchange.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Jesus was not about that.
Yeah. Precisely. There, you cannot buy place in line in the universe. It just doesn't work. It's like saying that you can change the spatiality between your neutrons and electrons. Like, have fun. What you need to do is realize the fact that your electron shell is mixing with everybody's.
That's called the field today.
You know, like, these are the things that he was literally telling us when you go through and start reading that. And
yes.
I'm not trying to get, like, Billy Graham on people or anything like that. Faith is faith. Religion is religion. Spirituality is spirituality. They all stand individually. And faith in particular comes from a realm of experience. And when you go through and start reading, like you said, the experiences that must historically have led to this form of thinking, it's pretty revolutionary.
Right. So did he come into the world with all of this knowledge as the Son of God, and he was already preset with all this pre-knowledge, or did he learn something? And my feeling is that it's a combination of both. He already understood kind of like his life's mission.
Yeah.
And then it had to be cultivated.
Yeah.
And so he already understood some very profound concepts. I mean, how else does a 12-year-old know this? I mean, there's a genius level of this stuff. And he had it, and then there was another training that was taking place during those years, those lost years. And I kind of narrowed it down to two things, but even though that there are two different, like, trains or pathways he could have taken, there were still certain things that occurred whether he went on one path or the other. So in my book, I explored Jesus trying to make a man of himself, he was like the merchant. He was the one who was engaged in trying to build his own business with the inheritance that he received, and it failed. And that during that period, he was able to kind of go through and explore the world more from the world of pleasure and the world of trying to make money. And so that was the way that I set the book up. But there was another path that I knew was possible, but I didn't want to go down that way for a variety of reasons, but here's the other path, and that is that Jesus spent an enormous amount of time in various schools learning all that he learned. And the reason why I know this is that when I'm going back to what are his inspirations, there are at least five inspirations that Jesus is being motivated by. And so one is his Hebrew wisdom and his Hebrew heritage.
Yep.
And you've already spoken to some of the mystical sides of things.
He had a deep cut understanding.
He completely understood that. Jesus has a very strong connection with the Essenes.
Mm-hmm.
So he was inspired by them. In fact, part of his ministry is based off of that, and part of his ministry is against that. So that, too, I explored in the book. Jesus, there's an Egyptian spirituality to some of Jesus' sayings. There is Greek philosophy and Greek rhetoric. And I would like to go back to the thing when you were talking about the one. Jesus I kept asking myself, what is the father to you and where did this come from? And it wasn't until I was reading Pythagorean metaphysics that the father shows up in his sayings and in his words, and that the father represented the one.
Yeah.
One.
Yep.
So here we have a direct connection to Greek philosophy, Greek metaphysics, using a term, a metaphysical term that Pythagoras used to describe another reality. And Jesus was also using that term to familiarize people and to give them a sense of what God was like. He was like a father. And of course, Jewish culture is very patriarchal. So Absolutely. The idea of a father would resonate with people. So this is very different than, this is very different than Elohim or Adonai or Yahweh. There's a different understanding the way Jesus was describing it. And of course, when it comes to a philosophical and a spiritual level, Jesus was talking a little bit like the way that you were discussing, you know, the nature of creativity. But he wasn't looking at the creator God as something outside of ourselves. He keeps bringing it back that the creator is inside of you.
Yes.
It's already here. There is no separation. And Jesus's ministry was showing people how there was no separation. Yeah. Okay, so then the last bit of information that this is really important when it comes to his inspirations that I was able to determine is that there's a very strong Eastern influence in Jesus's philosophy. Mm. So there is Buddhism, there's Hinduism, there's Taoism, and there's Confucianism. Yep. All four of those are embedded into those stories. Those concepts that you find in those religions are embedded in Jesus's practice and in his philosophy.
Yeah.
And his understanding.
Yeah. Many of his parables actually take me right back to the story of Confucius talking about how the river either moves the mountain or moves around the mountain.
That's Taoism.
Okay.
Confucianism was more like, Jesus quotes Confucian directly. Confucian said, do to others as you'd want them to do under you. Oh, my God. Yeah. I mean, that's really profound. So how do you get that specific when you're quoting specifically from Eastern religions? Okay. So, you know, when you kind of go through all of these ideas that I mentioned, again, I'm trying to piece Jesus's, life before he started his ministry. And how do you obtain all of this information? Is there some library that exists in the universe and all you have to do is tap into it? Okay, well, what's the process of that? Or do you have to go and study it? And of course, I feel like most of the things that you have to do in your life is that you have to study and you have to kind of participate in that whole learning experience. And that's my take on a lot of things.
And of course, depending on what school you belong to, there is the Akashic Record. You know, just the overall thread within the universe of what has and will be and could be, you know?
That's right. So, like, how do you – again, it goes back to how do you access that? And it either Jesus learned how to do that.
Yep.
And then he was able to, talk the way he did. And I believe that while Jesus was away from home – during those 18 years, one of the things that happened to him was a really, really profound kind of mystical experience. And in my book, I talk about a near-death experience that Jesus might have had. And then it relates again to, a little bit of a mirror here, is that it relates to the crucifixion and his resurrection. So I saw similarities of a near-death experience that he might have had during those 18 years, and then also his experience on the cross.
Wow, wow! And
so that was the intense enlightenment type of experience that he had to have. Something went on. Something occurred. And that might have opened up him in a way that now he's like a savant with all this information.
Well, quite obviously, it, quote, ran in the family. most people, at least that were following the quote messiahs of the time and the prophets of the time, were heavily looking at his cousin John the Baptist as candidate for the Messiah before Jesus just kind of randomly appeared on the scene.
Right. And like, so John like the Baptist
straight
is,
up it was is, it was like a Scrappy-Doo moment. I love you, Jesus, don't get me wrong. But it was straight up like, hey everybody, check out the cousin.
Well, this brings up this is the question that I asked. If you already understood who the Father was before you went to John the Baptist, what was the point of going to John the Baptist?
Yeah, the public show is a bit much, don't you think?
Well, now you end up getting into a whole other layer of what you – say that again?
It's not exactly the humble route.
No, Jesus is a master of theater, religious theater.
True.
He's a master of.
True. Absolutely.
And he used that to his advantage at all times. So he was a great marketer as well. So he understood – he had the mind of an entrepreneur. He had the mind of a merchant, and he had a mind of a marketer. And everything that he was doing to market and to sell was the Father. It's a remarkable – really a remarkable story.
Yeah. And now, granted, once again, trigger warning on the back end of this, this is not to discount any salvific process that you may believe in, people. This is not to discount Christ as the Son of God, or Jesus as the Christ, as the traditional Greek meaning of Christ, Christos, the anointed one, which is where we get the term chrism. But aside from that, whenever, like you said, you're building a profile of just a person, if you subtract that and go with them as just a capital H human being, fully God, fully man, as it says in the Nicene Creed, it really does set up for, like you say, guy's an entrepreneur. He knows how to market. He knows how to bring in a crowd.
And he knows how to use his disciples in ways to help him market.
Yeah. And I mean, one of my favorite examples that I used to talk about and spend an almost whole night about in class was the first miracle, the wedding feast of Cana. Where mom literally just left him holding the bag. Like, straight up. You know, they were like, oh my God, we're out of wine. Oh, gee. Well, yeah. You know.
What are you going to do?
Tell the head waiter to go over and talk to Jesus. And, well, woman, I'm not ready yet. Like, literally, the words out of his mouth. Like, hey. We ain't gotten to this yet. All right? Like, we got a launch plan here. Okay?
Isn't that funny? And look what he does with that. He turns it into wine, and everybody can get drunk.
He still turns it into, and not just wine, but the best wine. What kind of party is this where you bring out the best wine at the end of the party, where it just gets better and better? You know. So yeah, once again, turns it into that spectacular moment. It's not just the creation of water from wine, but it's that moment of, like you said, kind of entrepreneurial marketing and using that to stake a claim. Because yeah, a wedding, especially in any town, if you've ever attended a Jewish wedding or even a Hindu wedding, it's a thing. It's not just a one day thing. It's a thing. like, it is a happening. So That is story that would have been told in that town for generations.
That's correct.
For generations, that story would have been going around in Cana. And you could, as any PR agent nowadays would say, A, any publicity is good publicity, and B, you can't pay for that kind of publicity, kid.
That's right.
You know? Like, you got a golden moment right here. Either mom's right and you launch things right now and you just pull the string, or you go with the carefully crafted plan.
And I think Jesus was nimble enough to be able to move as the wind kind of blew, right? As opposed to saying, I'm sticking to a plan and this is how it's going to be done. He was flexible enough to be able to say, oh, well, look what just happened. Okay.
Yeah.
We're going that way right now.
Well, and even not just in his actions, but in his words.
He did the same thing in his words.
Yeah. And probably up around chapter 3 or so, you used one of my, I want to say Mark 10, maybe 10:9. I can't remember. Don't quote me. I mean, feel free to ground yourself around me, folks, because the lightning may strike at any moment. But one of my favorite turns of phrase from Jesus, be shrewd as snakes and gentle as doves.
Right. I kept working on that, kept thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it.
That is a marketing phrase, man. If that's not right. A marketing mantra, I don't know what is. It is now. Like, I've made a huge thing with it after I read it, like in Vector, so that I could print it out and have it on my wall. Because, be shrewd as snakes and gentle as doves. Because
how do you do that? You know, how does a personality go from a level of gentleness and purity and innocence to one that has this level of shrewdness?
Well, and what's interesting is at one point in life, I took it as an insult when it happened to me. And I'll tell you right now, I turned 18 a week after I was in the seminary, and I left at 18. I was there for a school year, you know. But one of the things that came back to me during my numerous evaluations, they evaluate you through that whole process for 9 years. You think it takes something to get a master's, like you get a master's in spirituality or in religion by the time you were done. But one of the many feedbacks that came back to me was that I quote, and this is direct quote, I live a duplicitous lifestyle. And I took that as an insult for years and years. And I guess in their scope and their point of view and what they were looking for, absolutely, a duplicitous lifestyle is the problem. However, that duplicitous lifestyle also means I got one foot firmly planted in reality. I got another foot firmly planted in my spirituality. That duplicitous lifestyle means that I'm also, while a full-on capital B believer with full, all capital letters, faith, I'm also willing to look at things with a fully skeptical eye and change my paradigm and way of thinking and say, I'm wrong. So my duplicitous lifestyle, though it may not befit you and your plan and what you need for somebody to lead a parish, boy, howdy, is it a great way to distill and process information.
Well, just remember, Jesus also was accused of being a glutton.
Yeah.
And you know, a partier and a one who hangs out with sinners.
Well, I mean, I don't have gout for nothing, buddy. That's right, I'm stricken with the 18th century illness. But I mean, when you get down to it, it really does kind of take that, as opposed to most quote priests in the order of Levi at the time, high priests, people like that, who were very much in a regimented way of thinking. If it did not fall within Leviticus, it is anathema. You know, this is verboten. In some interpretations of the Bible, the term is literally God hates that. That's how deep it goes with some actions. So for somebody like Christ to come in and be like, this person who is considered, quote, ritualistically unclean is not, is literally a whole new cultural concept.
And there's the flipping of the tables again.
Yeah. Yeah. Like when he came in and started preaching to lepers and started going out to them and reaching out, totally anathema according to Jewish teaching at the time.
Yes. I love it when he would walk up to somebody who was an invalid and his disciples would say, what did this person do?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning they are so filled with sin that what? Obviously God has punished them.
Yeah, what did you nothing. Or somebody in your family do to be stricken with such a demon?
So again, there's another one of those flipping of the tables. And he said nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, so one of the things that Jesus was trying to do was restore people. And that's what's really important here.
Yeah.
Is that he really was interested in trying to create people who were whole, wise, compassionate, and complete.
Well, and, you know, that's what you're trying to do here too, David. No offense. That is literally directly what you're trying to do, is build people who are whole and spiritually complete and understand that to put Jesus within that box is to limit things so wholly, and to limit you and your potential and the potential with which God created you so wholly. And I mean that like wholly, wholly. Like, you are not considering yourself as a whole and completed part of the universe, as a facet on that gem.
Yes, it is. And so he felt, you know, you can see that some of his frustration and anger is with a certain religious establishment.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the way that they were acting and what they were teaching.
Totally.
And he understood, based off of all of his research and all of his knowledge and all of his learning and all of his experiences, that there was something false about that. And that's why he did what he did on the Sabbath. And yep. Here's another like a little factoid. This is, again, there's all these little details that I thought were just so fascinating the more I got into it, because they're all there. It's just a matter of like how you process that and catalog it.
Yeah.
But when he went out and after he saw John the Baptist and he went out in the desert for 40 days, he didn't eat, right? And so then the priests come up to him, or the Pharisees come up to him afterwards while he's doing his ministry. He says, how come your disciples don't fast? And it's very fascinating to me that Jesus felt that he needed to fast for that, but that during his ministry, that wasn't necessary.
Well, and this is just me. I don't know what you found, but I'll take a stab at that. And that is quite literally the fact that through other teachings and other disciplines that he was taught during that missing 18 years, because he was only in ministry for 3 years before they finally said, okay, enough giving away the secrets of the universe to the common people without charging a dime.
Right.
As a matter of fact, begging your way along the way. so much not taking a dime, just living on the kindness of others. But it's within those other teachings that this is a common thread. It's within the teachings of Buddhism, Taoism, Taoism. It's within the teachings of the Near East and Far East that these concepts, in even in India, that these concepts are commonplace. They aren't something that's taken for granted. They're something that is engulfed in everyday life for the common person.
Yeah. I know that when I finally realized when in Hinduism, when Jesus says the Father and I are one,
yep.
I went, oh my God, that is directly from the Hindu concepts.
Yeah.
So yeah. He recognized it right off the bat that there is something inherently limiting to his Hebrew heritage.
Sure, sure, absolutely. And I think that there's something inherently limiting to that capital R religious concept with any heritage or mental spiritual growth, whether it be political. Like, that's one big reason why I am politically agnostic. I do not care what party you belong to. I want to hear what you have to say. And if my meter goes off, you get no vote. Like, I don't care what party you are, because to come at that in that way is to come at it the same way as, okay, does this align with Catholic teaching? Nope. Then it must not be.
Exactly.
And that, to me, is where you get into that religion of religion. You're losing the concept of spirituality. You're losing that concept of how does this help us all grow as a human race together, as a truth with a capital T, you know, a universal truth, the true meaning of the Greek word kathos that Catholic is based off of. And even my own faith, there's a reason why I don't really walk that path anymore. I'm a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, man. And I love the Christmas parties. I'll go out to bingo night anywhere, a fish fry. I see a Friday night fish fry. I am down with some catfish, my friend.
Bingo.
But I'm here to tell you, one of my favorite conversations around the campfire with a frosty mug is like, you know, Columbus never landed here, right? Just saying. Like, well, you know, he landed on the Bahamas. Great. That is not, that's like saying whoever found Guam found America. Like, nah. He was using somebody else's map, and he quite literally got lost before he found that. So, nah, he didn't land here, bro. Welcome to real history. And when he landed there, there were already some people there. So he didn't discover Jack.
That's correct.
But you have to be willing to put these dogmas and doctrines of society aside. And be willing to look at it with literal unadulterated eyes, within the lens of history, within the lens of what we know to be true historically. And that's what I've loved about this book, is that it really, really breaks down the world that Jesus lived in. And when you understand that, you can understand the message so much more.
Exactly. You know, there's just so many profound things to learn and to know. And I felt that religion offers a great deal of certain things, but it's in a band. Yes. And once you start getting to the edge of that band or on the other side of the band, all of a sudden you're in a different territory. So, and that makes it all the more difficult.
Absolutely. It makes it a lot harder to navigate, and it makes it a lot, not necessarily harder to navigate, but more detailed to navigate. There's a lot more nuance and a lot more understanding. And even to understand where the Jewish people came from is to understand their law. Is to understand their grasp of the world around them and how their law interacts with it and how all of that interacts with their God, capital G, you know? To me, it's an incomplete understanding to just read prima facie what is there.
Well, I think we all know that, there's different layers.
Yeah.
And, when you're entering into the system, you see it as one way, and then you start seeing it another way the more you get into it. And then eventually you just keep going down into those different stratas. Yeah. That's what happened with me.
And get into that for just a minute, if you don't mind. I mean, I know that we've kept you for a while now, but the conversation is great. And if you don't mind, we can keep going for another minute. But what was it that brought you to those stratas, and what were those stratas? Because like I said, I came from a straight up church service in the Catholic Church, and went, I would say, probably pretty wild rogue past that.
Well, and as you know, this is like,
it took me to a world of knowledge and a world of seeking and a world of truth, capital T, where like I can see these truths and where people were trying to get these points across in the words of alchemical texts and stuff like that. The words are no different. The teachings are no different. So,
there's several things. So part I already have kind of an innate interest in this material.
Yeah.
I also have a strong sense of the divine, that there's something much greater than myself out in the world.
Yeah.
And that I can know something of it and I can experience something of it. And then I started to realize that, and through a lot of experience and then also some research, that information is not always, it's available, but it's not always taught, or it's not.
Yes.
I found is that usually when I got close to something, then a new layer opened up. And I kept feeling that every time I kept making steps, that the world that I was trying to understand got bigger, and then I would understand more of it, and then it just got bigger again. And so it was just this, like, a succession of bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And of course, then the other things that started to happen was the faith got a little bit more challenging, a bit more,
yep,
you know, dicey.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, what you were expecting, which is this nice little world of you know, being comfortable, is not comfortable anymore.
It's
right?
It's more than uncomfortable, because and this is where I got and where a lot of ex-seminarians I know got, man, was to a point of bitterness.
Yes.
To literally a point of bitterness, because it's like, this is not a hard concept to get. How do all of you just blindly follow this?
That's correct.
And
so there's
hey,
a certain
that
element
does
of
not subtract faith, capital F. Like, the whole reason I do this show, man, part of the reason that I have people like Sev talk on, who says that she interdimensionally contacts aliens, people like Terry Lovelace, who said that he has missing time and experiences with alien abduction, Aaron Montgomery, stuff like that. Like, I entered the seminary because I, amongst my typical Sunday mass that I was serving at of 500-600 people on a Sunday at 6 p.m., had a unique religious experience where I was in the presence of God.
Yes.
And it was not an isolated experience in my life. And I have since learned to understand the feeling, at least that I know, of the presence of what I know to be God, and the presence of what I know to be whatever that other thing is. So,
well,
when I feel that presence, I just follow. I blindly follow. I am not going to question it whatsoever. I know the feeling. I know the tingle. I know the pull behind my belly button. And when I feel it, I follow it. And I do not doubt it once. But it took years to get to that point. It took years to get to the point of understanding that that was me and my experience of the divine around me.
Mm-hmm.
And the feeling of a ripple touching my ripple, you know?
That's right. All of a sudden, the two of you are merging, right? There's emergence of this.
And you feel it, folks. I know you've felt it, David. You walk in somewhere. It could be with 10 different people that you know. And you walk into a room and you're just like, wow, I need to really, really not be here right now. Run. Run. I don't care how much the lift is. I don't care if it's a 10-mile walk home. Get moving. Get out of there, dude. Do not doubt it. And you know that feeling, like things are just wrong. There's just something that's off, and to a point where it is distasteful to your body. I don't think that really, David, that requires any kind of harsh or disciplined spiritual training. I really don't.
That's where you're growing both your third eye, your intuition, and your sense. You know, as you we called it, the field. How big is your aura, and is it active? Is it alive? And are you sensing life around you? And is this dangerous or not? There's gut feelings. There's a reason why we call it a gut feeling.
Yeah.
Because your gut has intelligence. Your hands have intelligence. Your mind has intelligence. Your feet has intelligence. Your whole body has different seats of intelligence.
Absolutely. And that, like I said earlier, once you understand literally the quantum physics principle of how large your electron shell is, and the fact that anything you touch is 90% empty space. What you are feeling is a repulsion of electrons. It's not a solid object, not the desk right here, not the desk here, not the now empty decanter of gin. None of that is a physical object. None of it. My feeling of it is a repulsion of electrons. And once you understand that your electron field literally mixes with, like, I'm in Austin, Texas. I'm sharing my electron shell with a dude in Chile right now. According to all principles of physics that we know.
Right.
So to know that if I change my vibration, if I change the way that I think, that my ripple goes out that far. That's why I make the music I make, man. That's why I work with frequencies and make things like that. And you yourself have gone into making sacred Aquarian symbols, very, very much akin to the same thing, almost like solfeggio frequency images. Or cymatic images, almost, the artwork, and very, very interesting because it's based on color. It's based on frequency. This is just what I see from the images that you've sent me and what I do.
That's exactly what it is. People have asked me, what do these mean? And I go, well, they're nonverbal.
Yeah.
So, you know, what does a song mean? You can't explain a song. You just have to listen to it. And in this particular instance, these symbols have their own energy to them. So they're energetic and they resonate. And whatever that energy is, it is going to bypass your rational mind and just kind of immediately go into your heart, into your mind, into your subconscious. And eventually you're going to have some type of experience with it. And then if you start to really use those, symbols in a way, you can start changing the way you feel. You can start having, you know, you can start having more vivid dreams. You can start having mystical experiences. I mean, these things are very, very potent, very potent.
Absolutely. I'm going to get shameless on you here. This is actively a track that I wrote called Puer Ad Somnum, which includes Deep Theta Realm and Deep Delta binaural beats in the background, as well as the sound of like a child's heartbeat and a mother's heartbeat in utero. all kinds of things. But
oh, I hear that.
These sounds all have color attached to them. Every frequency has a color attached to it. And this stuff has been my dirty secret for years and years and years, David.
There was an entire art movement back in the late, I think it's like around World War One and into the 20s, called synesthesia, in which artists were trying to create color and music relationships.
Yeah.
Right? And so we now understand that a whole lot more, but they were really, I mean, here is these explorers going down that road and trying to understand it and put music and color together. I just love it.
And when we're off air after the show, I'll tell you about my upcoming album that I'm working on. I don't want to say it on air because I know somebody will steal it. And this is one of those that whenever I come out with it, guaranteed I could hit coast to coast with this album concept, because it is wild. But it's right down those lines. And for years, I made avant-garde music. The way I describe my music to people was, imagine watching a horror sci-fi movie with no words, only soundtracking and sound effects. So that could be really relaxing or that could be really disturbing. And I used these frequencies and these known frequencies and frequencies that I found and researched to literally move people's emotions with the music. So buried underneath the music would be the frequencies that make you physically uncomfortable or make you feel like something is watching you.
Right.
Things like that, to exude that feeling in the music. Now I'm using my powers for good.
I bet you you're making a lot of progress too.
It's been amazing. And what's funny is I just kind of released this stuff via happenstance, man. I didn't even have distribution for my music until COVID, and I had like 7-8 hours of content just as the artist, no disassemble that I am. And my distribution people were like, oh, well, you know, how much do you want to put out? I'm like, I got 6 albums like ready for you and 2 more that I'm coming up with artwork for.
Wow.
So, yeah, like I was like, I create like mad. It's not that incredibly hard for me to create this kind of stuff and just put it out. So why would I ignore that? Is kind of my mentality and concept. Like, if I'm already vibrating on that frequency, why would I fight that? Why would I go out and try to write country music?
Well, like you, these symbols, I've been working on these types of symbols since I was in my late 20s. So I get attuned to them and things start happening. And
now, how much for you starts as signal and frequency, and how much starts as inspiration?
Oh, that's okay. So,
because there's a beautiful, like literally going through these, and I'm popping them up on screen right now. And as somebody who owns a couple of actual oscilloscopes, who knows a little bit about cymatics, who knows a little bit about color and frequencies, an AV engineer, that kind of stuff. The colors of these and the shapes in the background and everything else are so spot on and beautiful. So I just got to know, it's one of those, like, does the verse of the chorus come first for you? Is it music or words? Is it color and frequency? Is it shape and color? What is it for you synesthetically that comes first when it comes to making
the first
these?
Because thing, the first,
they're hauntingly gorgeous.
And I beg you to go look in your books on all symbolism if there are any of these that you go, oh, there's that symbol. They're not. So there's something very new and unique about these symbols. And what I have done is that when I first started doing these, I would just sit for 3, 4, or 5 hours at a time and just draw. And then they started to get more frequent. Then I would be woken up at 1 o'clock in the morning for 3 hours. And that happened a lot. And I would just start accumulating more and more of these images. And I just created catalogs of them. And finally, not long ago, well, as of COVID, it was really important for me to start taking them from really simple colors to more complex colors and more complex shadings and more complex designs. So the way that those images that I'm talking to you about, and they have there's a complexity of background. The way that I saw that is that I had, again, one of my personality traits is that I'm an empath and I'm also a mystic. Mm-hmm. And so I had a mystical experience of the energy of the nest. So when birds create a nest, I got to experience that energetic principle of what a nest does to create life, right? To hold that life in the egg. And so I call the background the nest, and then the egg is that symbol. So that was a concept that I was working on last year when COVID happened. And I taught myself how to use Illustrator.
Well, and what I love about these, I myself, just in my esoteric studies and in the things that I do to manifest and kind of bring things about, I use a lot of different techniques culled from different studies. One of those is sigils. And the concept of a sigil, folks, magically, like capital M, you know, you could even say CK magical, is a symbol imbued with power, created specifically to manifest or imbue that power. Be it the sign of the cross, to sigil, Star of David, to sigil. These are symbols that are used in almost a ceremonial way and in a way to tune yourself to an action. And when I look at these symbols, which I'm showing on air right now, the blue symbol, and then the purple, and then the red, the three things that I see straight out, or four actually. Number one in the center is a sigil. It is a symbol that was made as part of a manifestation or as a result of that manifestation. A color associated with the frequency of that manifestation, as well as an image that would be kind of akin to a mandala. Or almost in some cases, when I say mandala, specifically the red one looks very mandala-esque. But whenever you go into the purple and the red, they look very cymatic, which even still is very mandala-esque. Whenever you start putting out the cymatic frequencies of certain things like 528 hertz, that kind of stuff, you start seeing mandalic shapes. That kind of thing, fractal shapes within the cymatic medium. The purple one specifically, I think, is one that just, it speaks to me on so many levels in the form of a waveform and cymatic on the outside. The color of it, the purple of it is so comfort and home to me. I love the disjointed trinity of the sigil in the middle. The concept of something always floating, whereas a triangle would be perfection, this is kind of the uncompleted triangle. And it's just, this is just my interpretation of looking at it. But it speaks to me on so many levels, and to know that this artwork made by you was made specifically for purposes. What was it that drove you to start creating this to begin with, David?
Those symbols started when I was in my late 20s, and I would find myself just kind of lost in the creation mode with pencil and paper for 3 or 4 hours. And these types of things would just keep showing up. And eventually what happened is that in the late 90s, there was an acceleration of them. I ended up meeting a woman who was in the process of building 7 sacred circles around the world, and I became part of that. And these symbols were channeled, some symbols were channeled to her, and that just triggered, you know, me to make even more. And so that happened. And then I ended up then being woken up, like I said earlier, like at 1 o'clock in the morning, and all I can see were all these types of symbols. And then I was on that for a while. And then once I was done with a certain set, the next layer was I ended up taking all of these sacred geometry shapes and drawing them over and over and over again. And after about 2 or 3 weeks of doing that for like an hour a day, like every day, my whole mind shifted and it opened up. And then a whole new set of symbols started to come to me. And so then that took me into, you know, creating an entire new set. So what you're now seeing is my need to put these like black and white images together that I was seeing and put color and energy through color into them, and using light and a little more complicated understructure. And I felt like all that was necessary. So there's nothing to me that this when the images were coming to me, they were about as sexy as a letter in an alphabet, right? There wasn't much to them. There wasn't any. There's like, oh, that seems very nice, but yeah, what is it? But then when I started to really introduce the color into the mix, then there's been another shift in me.
And how have you found the evolution of these happening? Is it something that because for me as an artist, my wife not too long ago, just before Thanksgiving, made fun of me before the release of one of my last albums, because we were on the road and driving out in the desert, and I was like, "Ooh, the album released today," and I put it on. And I was rocking out to it, and she's like, "You genuinely enjoy listening to your own music, don't you?" I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "Why?" And the way I explained it was that I do not toil over the creation of my music. I let things move where they're going to move. If I need to get rid of something, I just get rid of it. I don't toil over whether to keep it or not. If I feel like I need to get rid of it, I assume I feel that way for a reason. So I get rid of it until it feels right. And there's nobody changing my creative cycle except me. So when I feel that something is complete, I can move on. I don't have to beat a dead horse. I don't have to wait for somebody's approval. You know?
Everything that you just described is exactly what happens with me.
Interesting.
I know when it's done.
Yeah.
And I move on, and there's another one coming.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. Is it something that, because it's, for me, that creativity, that muse, the whole reason that I had somebody here at my studio today, and they were like, "Wow, like this space is created just for that. And it's in your house." And I was like, "Well, yeah." I mean, otherwise, whenever I had the idea in my head, how long would it take to set it all up? By the time I'm set up and ready to record, I'm tired, dude. I don't want to spend 30 minutes to an hour getting gear set up and, you know, setting up a template and a digital thing. Like, I hit two buttons and I'm recording, you know? And it really is that intent of making the space available for the muse, that when the muse comes to you, you can just go unabridged. At least that's what it's been for me for the last 20 years, is building that space. What is it for you with these Aquarian symbols that, I guess, motivates you to making them? Because, I mean, a lot of my music is based on literally what I hear in my head, whether it's what I heard in a dream or whether it's, you know, what I hear in my head walking down the road. But what is it for you that brings you to creating these and bringing them into being?
Well, part of it has to do with my complete fascination of shape. So, like, you know, you have a complete fascination with music and how music works. For me, it's all about how do lines intersect with one another? How is shape form? How can you create shapes that are outside the bounds of your basic circle and square or rectangle and octagon and triangle? How can you now make compelling images that are unique, inspired, and new and fresh and avant-garde and wild? So
yeah,
there's already been, you know, as an artist, there's always the issue of what is your voice? And I have found that one voice I have is the creation of a variety of shapes. And I've learned how to create shapes using different techniques. I cannot explain what happens at 1 o'clock in the morning, in which I wake up and all of a sudden I've got 20 shapes pouring out of me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Other than it happens.
Yep. I've tried to tell people
that's not just one time. That happens many times.
Yeah. Yeah, I've tried to tell people for years that I'm not physically present when I'm writing that. Like, I'm here, I'm composing, I'm putting things together, I'm moving things, but when I'm in the midst of doing that, I am somewhere else.
Yeah, you get transported.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to mention, when I was writing Interviewing Jesus, there were more than one time when I would go back the next day and read what I had written, and I sat there stunned going, I don't remember writing any of this.
Mm. Yeah, no. And I mean, even out of 10 years of being a twice, sometimes three times a week teacher of religion and spirituality, those classes where I walked out after an hour or hour and a half and had no idea what we just talked about, like, those are the ones that I had full confidence in, you know.
Those are the magical moments that artists are looking for.
Yeah.
Where all of a sudden you get so inspired that time starts to get lost. Mm.
Absolutely.
You know, that's why all of a sudden, I mean, my girlfriend, who's now my wife at the time, was going, you just spent 5 hours drawing.
Yeah.
What was going on? And then I would just show her, you know, these drawings.
Wow. Wow. And, you know, it really is that point of surrender, that point of acceptance, that point of willing to step beyond the bounds of the norm where most people are. Even going back to Interviewing Jesus, it's really being willing to meld numerous concepts together. Of the time period, the people, the location, what we know about Jesus in the words that are big and red, and putting all that together. And like you said, building a profile, even with stuff like this, learning to build a profile of recognizing that I need to sit down and draw right now. You know, like you get used to that feeling and you can feel it when it's coming on.
Yes.
You can feel it when it's getting ready to happen. And to know that, to be ready for it, I think is so important and so key. And it really is a muscular memory, whether it's spirituality, art, music, poetry, what have you. It's a not practice makes perfect, but practice makes ready situation.
And when you're ready, you know, you put in your time.
Yeah.
And you get present, things happen. So there are times it's just like, I don't feel like doing anything, but then you force yourself to do something and the magic happens. There are other times where, like I said, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning and the way, there's like somebody knocking on your head going, look at this.
Yeah.
And then there are other times where some of these images have come to me in which I've gotten really profoundly upset or physically ill or what. So, and very uncomfortable, right? And in some regards, a lot very painful. And these are not, sometimes some of these are not pleasant experiences.
Oh,
so I run the whole gamut of like complete awe to, oh my God, this thing is making me sick.
Yeah. Well, because you really do have to kind of leave yourself open. And unfortunately, sometimes it really is that I need to have the audio cue. I need to make it of the old lady from Poltergeist, you know, where it's, y'all mind stepping back? You're blocking my frequencies. because it really is the fact of it's other people where you're like, you realize how hard I am trying to manifest something right now. And I just cannot deal with your negativity. Like your negativity is quite literally negating every bit of my effort to try to make something happen.
There's always that interference too.
And to try to fight through that and to try to see that and to even recognize it is huge. Now, before I let you go, David, number one, thank you so much for all your time this evening. But I'm sure the question is burning on our audience's minds. Did you ever lose yourself amongst this, amongst the writing of interviewing Jesus? Did you ever get to a point where, I guess not dangerously, but perhaps quite really, you became more Jesus than David?
I made it a point to allow myself the opportunity to ask questions and then to visualize what it must have been like. So I was trying as much as I could while I was writing the book to be a cinematographer and a documentarian and just picture what it must have been like, what it must have smelled like, what it must have felt like, what it must have looked like.
Yeah.
Was there something in the air that might have been, you know, the frequency of like, oh, there's Messiah. There's just the oppression of the Jewish occupation? Is it the frustration of, you know, the temple priests and their monopoly on the, you know, their society? You know, I was really trying to get into Jesus's head and see the world through his eyes. I tried to put on his sandals and I tried to put on his garments so that I can feel that. And that's what I tried to do on a daily basis. And it happened. Things would happen.
Yeah.
And I can't explain it. Things would just happen. Like I said to you earlier, I would finish totally exhausted. Sometimes I would go upstairs and then I would hear the voice saying, you got that all wrong. And I'd go, what? The next day I'd have to go down and rewrite the whole thing. Or I would, right before I would go to bed, all of a sudden I'm asking 10 or 15 questions that never even occurred to me.
Yeah.
And there they were. Or, and then there was the next thing, I wake up in the morning and there was a fire in my belly, and it said, and I'd say, I'm so exhausted, I can't write today. And it was like, no, you're writing today. So there was this other presence that just kind of pushed this. And then there were times when I would be sitting in front of the computer reading what I had read the day before, going, I don't remember writing any of that. So something came over me. You know, it's the artist spirit, it's the muse, you know, whatever you want to call it, but there was definitely something going on. And it's not always something that I understand. All I can say is this happened to me, and these were the types of experiences that I had.
Yeah, and be willing to accept them for what they are. And hey, even for the gift of personal revelation that they are, whether they be any kind of spiritual depth. Once again, this is not by any means a spiritual manifesto. This is not a Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. You know, this is not a spiritual instruction manual, even. This is not a chicken soup for the soul or a eat, pray, love. But what it is, rather, is that deep exploration into quite literally probably the most influential person ever to have walked the face of this earth.
Yes.
Whether you accept the Son of God, Messiah, what have you. I mean, it's pretty... I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, David, but I'm pretty well. It's fact that Jesus existed.
Yes,
like
there's no doubt, dude.
He was real. He's not like some fable. Is the concept of Jesus, the Son of God, perhaps crafted out of numerous stories from various faiths around the globe? Sure, quite possibly. Not doubting that. But did Jesus the Nazarene in Galilee exist? Yes. He was a dude. He lived. And whether these experiences by your faith or not existed, folks, by somebody's account, they did. So what David does here is take these accounts and put them through the lens of history and really build, like he said, a really good, I think, dossier of who Jesus was, what he thought, and why he thought what he thought, because of the lens of where he lived and what he lived.
Yeah, I can't. You said it just perfectly and eloquently. I mean, this is a historical figure. And for me, what was very important was the psychological transformation. What does it mean to have this mission? Yes. What does it mean? How does one go about being called to and feel the call to do something? Yep. And how does that, what requires you to be able to do that? You know, you can't just say, oh, I think I'll go run a marathon today. You better go practice. You better go run, you know, 5 miles, 10 miles a day for, you know, 6 months. Same thing happened with Jesus. And then the call happens. He goes out and he does it. And all kinds of other things happen because of him honoring the call. And I wanted to understand the psychological process that was involved with that. And what he was willing to sacrifice to make something happen. Because he wanted to bring light. He wanted to bring light to the world. He wanted to feed the, he wanted to make people whole. He literally was, he had probably a broken heart to see all that was taking place and how miserable people were.
Well, and not just that, but how miserable his family and associates may have been due to his decisions. Because,
and then there was all of that.
Ladies and gentlemen, you think that there is cultural stigma or that there is doxing? We don't stone people to death in the square because of a rumor. We do like in a social media sense, but not in a literal sense. They did that. Like, that was a thing.
Yeah.
That was the law.
There were serious consequences.
Even a thing. That was the law.
There was serious consequences. Jesus knew that there was a death sentence as soon as he started his ministry.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And the fact that doing what he did and teaching what he taught, that he even lasted 3 years, is amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. And the only reason that I can think is that possibly some people within Sanhedrin level, things like that, once again, were like, oh, yeah, I remember that kid. I mean, it ain't cool. I'm not saying it's cool, but, you know, he's saying something, right?
Yeah, well, I think the initial ministry and its origins probably didn't get a lot of attraction.
No.
So there was, and he was so far north from Jerusalem that I don't think that there was a lot of people that really cared. You know, he's really not bothering anybody. But I think that what happened is it gained momentum. So just so I kind of believe that it gained more and more momentum is that early in the Gospels, you're going to see Jesus teaching more parables. And later in the Gospels, you're going to see Jesus speaking in aphorisms.
Yeah.
And the aphorisms are rhetorical defense mechanisms. It's a little bit like Tai Chi, where you're deflecting people's anger. Yep. Away, you know, and he seemed to be doing more of that later in the ministry than he did at the beginning.
Yeah.
So in the beginning of the ministry, he had probably more of an open time and hand to teach what he wanted to teach. And then later he was being more and more challenged.
Well, and you really, really see those challenges oddly coming as he nears Jerusalem and as he nears Palm Sunday. And as
That's
he
correct.
Nears the turning of the carts and the money changers' tables, where you do see priests approaching him and asking him these quandary questions, where he's like, "Well, pay to Caesar's what is Caesar's? Like, you can't not pay your taxes. What are you going to do? Not live? You know?"
He gets more aggressive too.
Yeah. And he gets very matter of fact about things. He finally just gets to a point where it's like, hey, it's either this or that, bro. Like, you're either going to make it into heaven, or it's going to be like a camel passing through the eye of a needle. One of the two, you know? And he really does start getting much more. And even if you read John, which is much more the I am gospel, the I am the way, the truth, and the light, that kind of stuff. Even then, he gets into that matter of fact tone, you know, and it's interesting that as things kind of come to that ending progression, they come to that literal culmination in the music, you know, that building, that crescendo of action, where it's like he knows the decisions he has made. He knows the consequence of the decisions he has made, and it's either one or the other.
And he's willing to go along with those decisions and the consequences of the decision.
Yeah.
And then he leaves everything up to the will of God.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's that Gethsemane moment, I think, is what most people are truly searching for in the world, David, when it comes to that connection with the divine, where it's that almost put the Lord to God to your test. But his was much more a I don't want to do this. This is the foregone conclusion. This is going to suck. It's going to be horrible. I could turn and I could run right now.
He had many opportunities.
Oh, absolutely.
And he did it.
At least three times that night before they even got to Gethsemane. You know,
so he could have said, I don't want to do. He could have said, I don't want to do this ministry. Yeah. After John, he's nah, I don't want to do that either.
Yeah.
And it all. And when John was executed, you'd go, oh, my God, this isn't going to work out. You know, if he could have left then.
Things are a little rough. So thinking about the family business again.
And then there was all the, you know, I think once he started doing his miracles, then more he got more people interested in him. And so now he has no, there's such a demand for him and for him to perform that then he's starting losing all of the energy just because of the demands of all these people.
Well,
you know, so it's like, I don't want to do this anymore, but he doesn't. He just goes back and regroups and then goes back at it again.
Well, even just to look back, like you were saying, at the dossier of Christ that you built, that dossier of entrepreneur and guru at the same time. And believe me, folks, this is a broad scope, macroscope comparison with Tony Robbins. All right.
Yes. Yes.
I think the difference is one of them got caught up in a Messiah complex and the other one fully knew what the consequences were and were willing to accept them. Tony Robbins being the one that got caught up in a Messiah complex. Not Jesus. Not Jesus. I think that really other people turned him into that afterward. That other people took this teaching and it's a beautiful teaching. It's amazing. It's phenomenal. It is world shaking. Man, like, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. It's world shaking. Like I said, even take away the anointed Son of God aspect, and Jesus of Nazareth is the most impactful man in the history of mankind, hands down. So even that, as a human being, period, says something. It says that your philosophy, your teaching, the mantra that you spoke meant something. Remove the salvific grace. Feel free. Bring it down to a point of utter philosophy, just words on a page. And he has moved more people than anybody else in the history of man. To good things and bad.
Yeah. He definitely embodied the person who talked the talk and walked the walk.
Absolutely.
Mean, he was personified as wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah.
My Lord.
The only way you could put it a better way is Socrates saying, I drink what? Like, I don't care. Like, I know I drank something bad. That's all right. I don't regret it at all. Because the truth, capital T, was worth it. Giving that truth of connection to the divine and the universe to the common person was worth it to Jesus of Nazareth. The
right.
The philosopher, the really one of the only ways you could put it is alchemist. Quite literally. When you start breaking it apart and you start looking at the concepts of alchemy and the fact that you were teaching a mystical tradition within word, and giving people keys to the universe within the mystical tradition through the power of word, same thing, no different concept. So yeah, he was a channel for something different. Divine Son of God, up in the air. I don't know, man, when it all ends and I head up to whatever, it could be Vishnu up there in charge. I got no idea. Good thing is I know about some Vishnu too. So at least I can fake it till I make it.
That's right.
Have yourself a good swath covered, folks, so no matter what, you can fake it till you make it. But the teachings of it and the fact that you have gone through in this book and married them with the common sense knowledge, the historical knowledge, the geographic and sociological knowledge of the people of the time, of the culture. It's so great and brings the teachings and the big red words into a whole new light, David. Thank you so much for your work in this.
Christopher, I really appreciate being on the show and being able to share, you know, the book, my ideas and how I came about doing it and my Aquarian symbols. I mean, just really, thank you very much for giving me this time.
Hey, the Aquarian symbols, since you sent them to me, have been something that I have just been emulsified in. I have been trying to soak them up as much as possible. When we're off air, I'll speak to that a little bit more. David, thank you so much for your time tonight. I greatly appreciate it. Before we go, one last time for shameless self-promotion, tell everybody where they can go. Other than the Dudes and Beer store at dudesandbeer.com/store, tell them where they can go to find out about upcoming appearances, where they can go to listen to old appearances, where they can go to follow your blog, where they can go to get their copy of Interviewing Jesus the Man by David Collis. Go for it, my friend.
Okay, well, I'm on Facebook. I have a new Facebook page called Sacred Aquarian Symbols. You can like that group. And my website is www.davidcollis.com. And my book, Interviewing Jesus the Man, is on Amazon. And you can either get a print version of it, an electronic version of it, or you can get an audio version of it. And it is on Amazon. Just type in my name, David Collis, or Interviewing Jesus, and you will go right to it.
Absolutely. David, thank you so much for your time. Once again, if you do have a moment, please do hold the line while we close things out, while you're online checking out everything from David Collis and the amazing book, Interviewing Jesus the Man, available at davidcollis.com, dudesandbeer.com, and amazon.com. Make sure to stop on by truehymnscience.com. Use code DUDE7, save 50%. Or save 7% off of your purchase of $50 or more. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. And until next time, drink responsibly.